Thank you for downloading this Finnish Institute of International Affairs recording. You can find more recordings at www.fiia.fi.
Well, good morning, everybody. Thank you, Bob, and especially thank you, Teja, and Mika, and all of FIIA for inviting me back to my favorite city. And it's good to see several old friends in the audience. It's not easy to be a commentator on a speech by Steve Flanagan. My initial impulse is to simply say I agree and then sit down in order to give more time for Q&A, and that would certainly please Bob, save 14 minutes. But one is, after all, supposed to sing for one's lunch, so sing I will. I do, however, agree with virtually everything that Steve said. I might have shaded his very last remark a little bit. I guess I'm not, even though I spent a good deal of my life on the Hill, I'm not quite as sanguine about whether or not Congress in a Trump administration would be able to exercise quite the restraining influence that you think so. But that's certainly up for debate. But let me just concentrate on a few of the highlights and extending some of Steve's most important points. At the outset, let me say that I think that on November 8th, Hillary Clinton will be elected the 45th president of the United States. The pundits are currently putting the odds at somewhat better than 4-1. But I must emphasize, and this is something that I wouldn't have said a year ago, I think we were all wrong in underestimating a lot of things about Donald Trump and maybe overestimating a lot about my fellow Americans, as one says. A victory by Trump is still quite possible. A majority of voters distrust Hillary Clinton, and the electorate this year is unusually volatile and susceptible to sensationalism. We've come to expect in the United States a so-called October surprise before every presidential election. I think that this year it won't be any surprise at all. Selective leaks of emails by Julian Assange, probably courtesy of Russia, will be tailored to put them in the most negative possible light. This is in no way excuses what I think was a really inexcusable blunder by Secretary Clinton having the private email server, but it's almost like the feds got Al Capone eventually on income tax evasion. If I had 40,000 emails, I'm positive that several of them would be ones I wouldn't like the rest of the world to see, so I think there'll be no problem whatsoever in finding a few and then massaging them. Calamities at home or abroad could occur, terrorism, for example, which would provide opportunities for demagogues. So obviously, it's quite justified for us to take a Trump presidency into account and for planners to do so. Now, as Steve said in his really outstanding speech, Secretary Clinton is very supportive of NATO. She values our allies. She understands security policy. She was a very active member of the Senate Committee on Defense Military Affairs. She understands, I think she understands Vladimir Putin. He's not wild about her, that's for sure. If she's elected president, as Steve said, I think the essentials of U.S. security policy towards NATO in general and Northern Europe in particular will remain. There will be continuity. As he said, a key question is whether she would push for upgrading NATO's enhanced forward presence, the tripwire forces of four rotating battalion-sized units in the Baltic states and Poland, to make them a credible deterrent. I'm giving some value judgment. I don't think they really are a credible deterrent right now, and here I'm, of course, relying on the RAND study of Steve's colleagues in this regard. Also, the question of whether or not she would provide lethal defensive weaponry to Ukraine is very important. Trump, who labels his foreign policy America First, has concentrated more on a fear, on stoking fears of Islamist terrorism, especially ISIS. He's highly skeptical of, even hostile towards NATO, perhaps because he doesn't see a threat from Russia. He rather simplistically views the alliance purely in transactional terms, strikes me as pro-Russian, and openly admires Putin. In March of this year, meeting with the editorial board of the Washington Post, Trump said that U.S. involvement in NATO may need to be significantly diminished in the coming years. And of course, this breaks with nearly seven decades of consensus in Washington. We certainly can't afford to do this anymore, Trump said, adding later, NATO is costing us a fortune, and yes, we're protecting Europe with NATO, but we're spending a lot of money. Well, as with most of his statements, domestic and foreign, he's backtracked since he got the nomination, and Steve alluded to this. He's now talking about cooperation with NATO versus ISIS. Call me a skeptic, but I'm not sure how much these changes mean, and in view of basically the fact that he changes all the time. What for me is much more ominous is the fact that Trump has extensive investments in Russia. His son let the cat out of the bag in a speech a few years ago. Since he won't release his tax returns, we don't know exactly how much, but his son said they're extensive. And he surrounded himself with pro-Russian senior advisors. Again, as Steve said, former campaign chief Paul Manafort was a key advisor to Viktor Yanukovych. Carter Page, another chief advisor, has advised Gazprom on acquisitions, holds stock in the company, worked for the pro-Russian oligarch Viktor Pinchuk in Russia, and Page has publicly criticized the sanctions that the United States and the EU have put on Russia because of its invasion of Ukraine. Then there's retired General Michael Flynn, former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, who was pictured sitting at the head table with Putin at a banquet in Moscow last year, celebrating Russia Today, a propagandistic international broadcasting network funded by the Russian government. And earlier this month, Flynn accompanied Trump at his first national security briefing. One of Trump's most prominent supporters, former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, dismissed Estonia as a suburb of St. Petersburg. All this has led the Latvian journalist Dainis Ivans to fear a Putin-Ribbentrop pact. What would a President Trump actually do in regard to NATO? I have to say, for me, it's unclear, just as virtually everything else about this unpredictable, unstable man is. So it's hardly surprising that Finland, as you all know, is currently negotiating a defense collaboration agreement with the United States, which it hopes to conclude before the U.S. elections in the fall. Sweden signed a similar agreement with the U.S. in June of this year. By the way, incidentally, we have fringe candidates this year who are polling anywhere between 10 to 12-13%, and they resemble Donald Trump in their views of NATO. Gary Johnson, who's the Libertarian candidate, former governor, Republican governor of New Mexico, has come out against Article 5. I saw him on TV just a few weeks ago saying that. We have a Green candidate named Jill Stein. She's anti-military in general, blames NATO for allegedly encircling Russia, and has a running mate on the Green ticket who talks about the gangster states of NATO. I'm not happy to have to report these things, folks, but they're there. Steve said renewing EU sanctions on Russia after they expire on January 31st of next year is of central importance. As you know, Slovakia currently occupies the rotating EU presidency. Its prime minister, Robert Fico, is an unpleasant populist in the mold of Putin, has called for ending the sanctions. Given the fact that Trump was strongly in favor of Brexit, is openly contemptuous of the EU, and last week welcomed Nigel Farage, the former UKIP leader, at a rally in Mississippi, President Trump would have little leverage with the EU, even if he wanted to extend the sanctions on Russia, which he probably doesn't. Ladies and gentlemen, foreign policy must be organically connected to domestic politics. An American president doesn't make policies by plebiscite, but as my old boss Joe Biden likes to say, no U.S. foreign policy can succeed without the informed consent of the American people. If Hillary Clinton wins, despite the proven constancy of the United States as an ally, I believe U.S. foreign policy may eventually enter a qualitatively new phase. I'm not talking about a radical change, I'm talking about shading. If she does win, the Democrats may recapture the majority in the U.S. Senate by a razor-thin margin. If I had to bet right now, I would say it'll be a 50, if she wins, it'll be a 50-50 deadlock, and the 51st vote would come from the Vice President Tim Kaine, acting in his capacity as President of the Senate. According to Article 2, Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution, however, a two-thirds majority in the Senate is required to ratify treaties. That means that a committed neo-isolationist minority could, for example, block the accession of new countries to NATO, an issue which may concern Sweden and or Finland in the foreseeable future. We could talk about, I was involved in the first round of post-Cold War NATO enlargement, and the debate, the eventual vote was 80 to 19, but it could have gone either way until a few days before the vote. Such a minority might also block ratification of TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TTIP, more about that in a minute. Isolationism, or at least neo-isolationism, has a long history in the United States, and in this year of massive popular dissatisfaction with the status quo, the public has turned against foreign involvements. And it's not just a matter of ideology. As Steve said, the war in Afghanistan drags on. It's now the longest war in American history, and despite huge expenditures of U.S. and allied blood and treasure, the Taliban remains vibrant in the field and capable of capturing provincial capitals. I won't even bother to criticize the illogic of Trump, who is against nation building but wants to combat Islamic radicalism. I mean, that's almost too silly for commentary. The second war in Iraq is generally seen in the United States as a mistake sold to the American public by President George W. Bush under false pretenses. Worse, if possible, is the sad fact that, again, despite thousands of American battlefield casualties, approaching 4,500, and I see I have two more minutes, we're still fighting there. Just an aside, until about 8 weeks ago, I lived in Törlö, and I used to, in the evening, sometimes walk over to Hietaniemi Cemetery. Partly because Mannerheim is one of my heroes, and partly just to get a better feel for the country. And you look at the gravestones there, and you see that Finnish soldiers died, where they died, most of them in Karelia, a few in Lapland. But at least they were dying for their country. How would you feel if you were an American and you knew that your son or daughter fought to liberate Fallujah or someplace, or Ramadi, somewhere west of Baghdad, and then it was abandoned overnight when ISIS swept in a year and a half ago? All I'm trying to say is I am certainly not an isolationist, but it's not just a matter of ideology. There are reasons why people feel this way that go way beyond ideology. I was going to say something about TTIP, and perhaps we'll leave that for the Q&A. Count me as someone who thinks that the stress by the Sanders people and by Trump against international trade agreements is profoundly misguided. I think that, of course, there are always going to be winners and losers, and we have neglected the losers shamefully in the United States. I'm not going to cast stones, except a lot of the people who propose to be the most pro-free trade are the ones who refuse to appropriate the money for retraining and educating people who lost their jobs, but that's another story. The fact is, I think that TTIP is a political football in Europe now, as well as the United States. Just look at Germany, Sigmar Gabriel, the vice chancellor, saying it was dead just a few days ago, TTIP, basically because he's afraid the trade unions won't support the Social Democrats. François Hollande yesterday essentially said the same thing. The speaker for the European Commission contradicted both of them. So, I mean, I don't have any schadenfreude to realize that politics is alive and well in Europe as it is in the United States. I think it's a profound mistake. I'm probably over by 30 seconds, so I'll stop. Thanks, Bob.